Imagine the economy has crashed. You've lost your job, and you're living in your car trying to fend off gangs of roving thugs. And then you see an ad for a full-time job that comes with a comfortable suburban home. There's just one catch. You get to live half-time in the house, but the rest of the time you have to live in prison. Welcome to Margaret Atwood's latest speculative fiction.
Ed opens his arms like a TV preacher. His voice gets louder. If prisons were scaled out and handled rationally, they could be win-win viable economic units. So many jobs could be spawned by them. Construction jobs, maintenance jobs, cleaning jobs, guard jobs, hospital jobs, an ever-flowing cornucopia of jobs. Medium-sized towns with large penitentiaries could maintain themselves, and the people inside such towns could live in middle-class comfort. And if every citizen were either a guard or a prisoner, the result would be full employment. And since it was unrealistic to expect certified criminality from 50% of the population, the fair thing would be for everyone to take turns, 1 month in, 1 month out. Think of the savings, with every dwelling serving two sets of residents. It was timeshare taken to its logical conclusion. It all makes sense.
Margaret Atwood's new novel, The Heart Goes Last, blends dystopia with social satire. Her two main characters, Stan and Charmaine, are a young married couple. They're barely scraping by, and when they hear about the Positron Project, they jump at the chance to live in that nice, cozy house in the town of Consilience, even if it means they also have to spend time in prison. Of course, since this is a Margaret Atwood novel, that's the point at which things get pretty weird. Steve Paulson asked how she got the idea for this one.
The genesis of it, the premise of it, is that there has been a 2008-style economic collapse in Stan's and Charmaine's part of the country. That would probably be the Detroit-like part. A lot of people lost their houses in that financial meltdown, and a lot of businesses closed. So Stan and Charmaine have had jobs. They've had a house. They've had a mortgage. But they have lost those things in the meltdown, and they're now living in their car, which is unpleasant and also dangerous because the area is full of vandals and people on the loose who would like to get hold of their car. So when they see the Positron Project being advertised with a digital tour of the house they would get, it's just so appealing. You get white fluffy towels, you get sheets with flowers on them, you get a bed. It's not actually very comfortable sleeping in your car. All of this is just very appealing, and they apply and they get in.
So the story is set, I presume, somewhere in the near future.
Yeah.
And as you say, society is crumbling, basically. And so then this prison with a smile seems to offer refuge.
It does offer refuge. Think of the alternatives. But there are some questions to be asked about it. And Stan is the more skeptical of the two, and he starts asking them to himself pretty soon. He wants, for instance, to know if it's a private for-profit prison scheme, how is the profit being made? And Stan would also like to know what happened to the actual criminals who were in there before it became the Positron prison scheme.
Why were you drawn to this coming together of prison life and community life?
Well, I guess because I started thinking about it a long time ago when I was a Victorian literature student. It was a big theme for a number of writers in that era, notably Charles Dickens, who was pretty obsessed by prisons because his dad was in one when he was a child. So I started then, and the history of prison reform in that age, but also the history of for-profit penal colonies, of which North Carolina was one. So Australia is particularly instructive because at first they shipped only men to that colony, but then they realized the men were quite rowdy and they decided to send some women to get married to them and settle them down. But they didn't have a lot of women housebreakers. In fact, they didn't have any women housebreakers. So they lowered the bar on what you had to do to get transported if you were a woman. They criminalized more things because they needed to fill a quota. And any time you've got a system like that has a quota, you're going to see that effect.
So it would seem that on the surface that your novel is kind of this crazy dystopian story of a society gone amok. But you're suggesting maybe it's not so far off from the real world?
I don't put things in those kinds of books that I write that are far off from the real world.
You want to have something that's just, you look at things...
Just around the corner. Just a couple of different decisions and we'd be there.
Hmm. It turns out that your town of Consilience has a lot of rules. No rock music allowed. You can't interact with family outside of Consilience. There's heavy...
You're
heavy surveillance. All the communication with the town is monitored. Is this strictly an imaginary landscape for you? Or do you...
No. No, it's kind of where we live. As we have learned, there are a lot of people listening in on us.
So the surveillance in particular, that's what you see as the, especially the real world analogy here.
Oh, there's more than one real world analogy, but that's one of them. The other one is in the field of personal robotics, which are making great strides. You can catch up on Pepper, the robot that can read the expressions on your face, and you can catch up on the Japanese who have now made a simulated person whose skin can get goosebumps. And the man in California who is making really quite interesting talking sex bots.
Well, and sex bots figure prominently in your story. I mean, these lifelike androids, you call them prostabots, essentially sex robots.
I didn't make that up, actually. If you put prostabots in on your web searcher, that's what you'll get.
So one of the questions you seem to be asking in the story is that if we're offered enough pleasure, and if we're provided the basic comforts of life, would we be willing to give up the freedom we have in the outside world? Essentially, could we be happy if we're willing to check our free will at the door?
Or some of it. You know, history has shown that when people feel really frightened, they will choose options that provide safety, or that they think provide safety, and they will give up some of their freedoms in return, and it's happened time and time again.
If you had to classify this novel, what would you call it?
No, let's not go there.
No, I mean, dystopian fiction, is that what it is?
Yeah, partly, mm-hmm.
You don't like having your fiction called science fiction, do you?
Well, if it were, then I wouldn't mind it at all, and I've written some shorter pieces that are definitely science fiction. But when people use that term, they pretty much think of, you know, spaceships, aliens, those sorts of things.
You prefer speculative fiction to describe your own work?
I think it's more accurate. This whole genre had two granddaddies, and one of them was Jules Verne, who wrote about submarines and things like that. He was writing about things that he thought were happening or would happen or could happen. And the other one was H.G. Wells, and he wrote War of the Worlds and The Time Machine, which are two of the big seminal works of sci-fi. He wrote about things that, you know, just weren't going to happen. Martians being shot from Mars in tin cans, and they turned out to be super intelligent sort of tentacled heads that ate people or sucked the blood out of them. And Jules Verne, when he heard about that, he was horrified. He said, but he's making things up. So those are the two origins, and I think there are two families in that area. And the Jules Verne one led to people like Orwell, and the H.G. Wells thing led to things like Star Wars. So I'm in the Jules Verne family of that kind of fiction.
Why do you think we are seeing so many dystopian books and movies these days? I mean, they're everywhere.
Of all kinds, you know, fantasy and reality. I think it's partly because people feel unsettled about the future, especially young people, and they are envisaging a future in which there's a lot more social instability, and climate change is factoring into that in really a big way. In fact, there's a whole subgenre called cli-fi, which is climate fiction. So I think that's coming just from where people fear that they are, just as George Orwell's 1984 was written in 1948, and it was about Soviet-style socialism as it would get played out in England if it were to be played out. Stuff comes from where we are. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, I think he was traumatized by a visit to Hollywood in the 30s. What he was. Oh, no, oh, no. There's going to be perfume fountains. What are we going to do?
Well, and various people have said that if you want to point to dystopian stories, Huxley's Brave New World is maybe more accurate than Orwell's Big Brother world. I mean, sort of being killed
combo.
By pleasure.
Yeah, but I think it's a combo. For instance, Orwell got the surveillance right, no question. Right after the Cold War ended and the wall came down, everybody thought it was going to be Huxley all the way. But I think we now realize that we're living in a blend, that each one of them got some of those things right.
Well, speaking of sort of imagining what the future might be like, you did something kind of crazy not that long ago. I mean, you wrote a novel for this project in Norway called The Future Library. It's been placed in a sealed box and won't be open for 100 years?
That's it. I'll describe this project to you, which was cooked up by a 34-year-old conceptual artist called Katie Patterson. And Katie's idea was and is, in a Norwegian forest near Oslo, 1,000 trees have been planted and they will grow for 100 years. And in each year of that 100 years, a different writer around the world, any language, will be asked to contribute a manuscript to the Future Library. Any form, doesn't have to be a novel, it could be one word. And the other rule is you can't tell what's in the box. You can reveal the title, but you can't reveal anything else about it. This project seized the imaginations of people all around the world because it's so hopeful. It assumes there will be people. They will be able to read. The library will still exist in 100 years. The forest will still exist. Think of all of that hopeful stuff in there.
Yeah. What's the title of your book?
The title of my book is Scribbler Moon.
It's kind of it's a fascinating imaginative exercise because I would think one thing you'd have to do is to think about what people would want to read 100 years from now.
Well, of course, you have no idea any more than you have any idea of what people would want to read now. It's, all of that is gambling. But I think every time you're writing anything, you're addressing an unknown audience. But I was the kind of child who liked to bury things in jars in the backyard and was quite thrilled whenever I was digging around, doing gardening and whatever, to find something from an earlier age. I love those stories of people discovering caches and hoards and things that were buried and have lain unknown for up to, you know, thousands of years.
That's Margaret Atwood talking with Steve Paulson about her new novel, The Heart Goes Last.